Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio, your intelligence briefing in the war for the free world. I'm Kyle Scheidler of the Center for Security Policy. I'm filling in today for Frank Gaffney, who is off on a much-deserved vacation. Joining me now is Marie Espinoza. She's the National Director of the Remembrance Project, which honors and remembers Americans and legal residents who have been killed by illegal aliens. Maria, thanks for coming on today.
Hello, Kyle. Thank you so much for inviting me on your show.
We're always glad to have you. Maria, I wanted to talk to you about this recent situation that's been in the news regarding the death of Edwin Jackson. He was a linebacker for the Indianapolis Colts, and he was killed when he and his Uber driver were struck by a drunk driving illegal alien. This is a story that made the news quite a bit because of, Edwin Jackson's fame as a football player. But this is a sort of story that, in reality, takes place across this country all the time. Isn't that right?
Absolutely, Kyle. And, you know, Edwin Jackson won't be the last. And Jeffrey Monroe, who was the Uber driver, was also killed, and he was 54 years old. You know, I'm sure he had a family to support, and just trying to make an extra buck being an Uber driver. But this is exactly what's taking place all across the United States, and that's why the Remembrance Project created the Stolen Lives Quilt banners in order to connect the dots for the American public, because the fake news, now we know, does not report it. But, you know, in 2009, when we started, we realized that this was an epidemic of killings of Americans by people who should not be here in the first place.
Maria Espinoza, do we have solid statistics on the number of Americans or legal residents who have been killed by illegal immigrants?
No solid statistics, Kyle, and that's very unfortunate because as Americans, we should be able to have that at our fingertips, and our government should give that and publicize those statistics. Last year, my husband, Tim Ling, and myself met with Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and that was the million-dollar question, you know, we've been asked for years. And he said it's impossible to obtain these statistics because the municipalities do not collaborate or cooperate with the federal government.
That's highly problematic. I mean, of course, when we think about the reality of this thing, is the federal government requires from the states and local governments all manner of crime statistics, and they put out large reports on the number of violent crimes and the number of murders, the number of hate crimes, for example, and they spend a great deal of effort collecting this information. So I feel like if there was the political will to do so, they could get decent information about this information. Do they really want to?
Right. They really don't want to, you know, and there are some information out there, but, you know, obviously the left rebuts it with something else. So we need to find out who is gathering information, who is not cooperating, and take those individuals to task. Now, these are elected officials who are obstructing the federal government in obtaining those statistics. And look, Kyle, we have Title 8, Section 1324, that we can go after, the DOJ can go after these elected officials who aid and abet illegal aliens, you know, having to do with sanctuary cities. You know, these sanctuary cities do not cooperate with the federal government. You know, we need to get those people out of the way. And I think that your listeners can help by writing and emailing to the Department of Justice demanding that these obstructors be prosecuted. And it's every right. It's right there. It's a law that we can, as a tool that American people can use.
I think that's a really good point. And it's a point that's been raised, I think, if I'm not mistaken, by the Trump administration's ICE director and others that have expressed increasing frustration with the role of the leaders of these sanctuary cities, and even in the cases, for example, California, of sanctuary states. Maria, I wanted to ask you on that topic, how has the Trump administration changed the way that this topic is discussed? We saw, obviously, President Trump tweet out a comment about the death of Edwin Jackson. He also, I think, very effectively used the State of the Union recently to highlight some of these stories as well. Have we seen a change? Have we turned the corner in the way that the administration talks about these issues?
Absolutely, Kyle. And the change is this. It's simply now being discussed, where it was swept under the rug. And you're right, in the State of Union address, you know, he addressed the families of Nisa Mickens and Kayla Cuevas, you know, who were brutally tortured and murdered, macheted, and all by the MS-13 gang members. So this is going around all across the United States. And just the fact that we are talking about this is huge. But now we have to have the public turn that corner where they actually want to do something about it. And I think that there's a groundswell of good Americans who want laws and don't want this nation to become a lawless nation, gather behind your elected officials and demand, you know, civilly and nicely but sternly, demand that they enforce existing laws. No amnesty, of course, and follow our U.S. Constitution and legislate for the betterment of Americans and our country. And it's quite simple, Kyle. But you obviously you have special interests, and you know we have voting bloc on this side and reelection campaign funds on the Republican establishment side, and it just seems like they're all eating out of the same trough. But we, the people, have that powerful vote, and we can force these individuals to legislate the way we want, or we have to kick them out. Unfortunately, some we have to wait a couple years to get them out of office, but I think we need to find a little loophole in there that we can use to get them out sooner if they're not doing their jobs, just like anyone else would be removed from their positions by their employer if they weren't doing the job that they were supposed to do.
Well, you know, you raise a really good point about education and the public. I mean, I remember seeing a comment in the news that after President Trump's State of the Union speech, the number of people Googling MS-13 shot up because they wanted to know more about it. They weren't being told about it, so they were seeking out the information after it was brought to their attention. I think that's a really good point. And, you know, as we discuss this education of lawmakers and holding them accountable, we really see a battle of the narratives. And we saw that on display earlier this week when Nancy Pelosi took to the floor of the House, you know, for 8 or 9 hours telling stories, and I emphasize the word stories, of dreamers, so-called. Where are our politicians, you know, on the Republican side, on the conservative side? They need to get up there as well, and they need to start telling stories of real Americans. And I think, you know, I think Maria Espinoza, you and the Remembrance Project can certainly help them do that if we can, you know, lash you up with some of the politicians that do want to tell these stories.
Well, we are connected, Kyle, and that's the sad part, is because they know we're here and we've reached out to them, and some of them simply won't speak to us for answer. This is a perfect example. I'm glad you mentioned this, because in a year and a half ago, four angel mothers and one family, angel family, went to Paul Ryan's home. This is heat of the summer, very hot. The mothers and family members were wearing their memorial shirts of their children or their loved one, and with their individual Stolen Lives quilt banner of their loved one. And we wanted just a few minutes to talk with Speaker Paul Ryan and to tell them their stories and just help him do a better job to represent Americans. And he absolutely refused. In fact, he jumped into his security detail Suburban, and both vehicles just sped away. I mean, he didn't even come out to give his condolences or say, "I'm so sorry for the loss of your son or your daughter." You know, this is what we have in our leadership, Kyle. So if people don't understand that by, you know, now, you know, it's very obvious that every single politician knows what is taking place, but yet they sit on their hands and they're unwilling to protect you, the American. This is where we are today. That's very disturbing and actually very dangerous for our country.
Well said, Maria, and it reminds me of President Reagan saying that if you can't make your elected officials see the light, then make them feel the heat. So we appreciate all that you are doing to make them feel the heat on this very important issue. Maria, thank you very much. We will be right back with our next guest here on Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio, your intelligence briefing in the war for the free world. I'm Kyle Scheidler of the Center for Security Policy. I'm filling in today for Frank Gaffney, who is off on a much-deserved vacation. Joining me now is Marie Espinoza. She's the National Director of the Remembrance Project, which honors and remembers Americans and legal residents who have been killed by illegal aliens. Maria, thanks for coming on today.
Hello, Kyle. Thank you so much for inviting me on your show.
We're always glad to have you. Maria, I wanted to talk to you about this recent situation that's been in the news regarding the death of Edwin Jackson. He was a linebacker for the Indianapolis Colts, and he was killed when he and his Uber driver were struck by reportedly a drunk driving illegal alien. This is a story that made the news quite a bit because of, obviously, Edwin Jackson's fame as a football player. But this is a sort of story that, in reality, takes place across this country all the time. Isn't that right?
Absolutely, Kyle. And, you know, Edwin Jackson won't be the last. And Jeffrey Monroe, who was an Uber driver, was also killed, and he was 54 years old. You know, I'm sure he had a family to support, and just trying to make an extra buck being an Uber driver. But this is exactly what's taking place all across the United States, and that's why the Remembrance Project created the Stolen Life Quilt banners in order to connect the dots for the American public, because the fake news, now we know, does not report it. But, you know, in 2009, when we started, we realized that this was an epidemic of killings of Americans by people who should not be here in the first place.
Maria Espinoza, do we have solid statistics on the number of Americans or legal residents who have been killed by illegal immigrants?
No solid statistics, Kyle, and that's very unfortunate, because as Americans, we should be able to have that at our fingertips, and our government should give that and publicize those statistics. Last year, my husband, Tim Ling, and myself met with Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and that was the million-dollar question, you know, we've been asked for years. And he said it's impossible to obtain these statistics because the municipalities do not collaborate or cooperate with the federal government.
That's highly problematic. I mean, of course, when we think about the reality of this thing, is the federal government requires from the states and local governments all manner of crime statistics, and they put out large reports on the number of violent crimes and the number of murders, the number of hate crimes, for example, and they spend a great deal of effort collecting this information. So I feel like if there was the political will to do so, they could get decent information about this information. Do they really want to?
Right. They really don't want to, you know, and there are some information out there, but, you know, obviously the left rebuts it with something else. So we need to find out who is gathering information, who is not cooperating, and take those individuals to task. Now, these are elected officials who are obstructing the federal government in obtaining those statistics. And look, Kyle, we have Title 8, Section 1324, that we can go after, the DOJ can go after these elected officials who aid and abet illegal aliens. you know, having to do with sanctuary cities. You know, these sanctuary cities do not cooperate with the federal government. You know, we need to get those people out of the way. And I think that your listeners can help by writing and emailing to the Department of Justice demanding that these obstructors be prosecuted. And it's every right. It's right there. It's a law that we can, as a tool that American people can use.
I think that's a really good point. And it's a point that's been raised, I think, if I'm not mistaken, by the Trump administration's ICE director and others that have expressed increasing frustration with the role of the leaders of these sanctuary cities, and even in the cases, for example, California, of sanctuary states. Maria, I wanted to ask you on that topic, how has the Trump administration changed the way that this topic is discussed? We saw, obviously, President Trump tweet out a comment about the death of Edwin Jackson. He also, I think, very effectively used the State of the Union recently to highlight some of these stories as well. Have we seen a change? Have we turned the corner in the way that the administration talks about these issues?
Absolutely, Kyle. And the change is this. It's simply now being discussed, where it was swept under the rug. And you're right, in the State of Union address, you know, he addressed the families of Nisa Mickens and Kayla Cuevas, you know, who were brutally tortured and murdered, macheted, and all by the MS-13 gang members. So this is going around all across the United States. And just the fact that we are talking about this is huge. But now we have to have the public turn that corner, where they actually want to do something about it. And I think that there's a groundswell of good Americans who want laws and don't want this nation to become a lawless nation, gather behind your elected officials and demand, you know, civilly and nicely but sternly, demand that they enforce existing laws. No amnesty, of course, and follow our U.S. Constitution and legislate for the betterment of Americans and our country. And it's quite simple, Kyle. But you obviously you have special interests, and you know, we have voting block on this side and reelection campaign funds on the Republican establishment side. And it just seems like they're all eating out of the same trough. But we, the people, have that powerful vote, and we can force these individuals to legislate the way we want, or we have to kick them out. Unfortunately, some we have to wait a couple years to get them out of office, but I think we need to find a little loophole in there that we can use to get them out sooner if they're not doing their jobs, just like anyone else would be removed from their positions by their employer if they weren't doing the job that they were supposed to do.
Well, you know, you raise a really good point about education and the public. I mean, I remember seeing a comment in the news that after President Trump's State of the Union speech, the number of people Googling MS-13 shot up because they wanted to know more about it. They weren't being told about it, so they were seeking out the information after it was brought to their attention. I think that's a really good point. And, you know, as we discuss this education of lawmakers and holding them accountable, we really see a battle of the narratives. And we saw that on display earlier this week when Nancy Pelosi took to the floor of the House, you know, for 8 or 9 hours telling stories, and I emphasize the word stories, of dreamers, so-called. Where are our politicians, you know, on the Republican side, on the conservative side? They need to get up there as well, and they need to start telling stories of real Americans. And I think, you know, I think Maria Espinoza, you and the Remembrance Project can certainly help them do that if we can, you know, lash you up with some of the politicians that do want to tell these stories.
Well, we are connected, Kyle, and that's the sad part, is because they know we're here and we've reached out to them, and some of them simply won't speak to us for answer. This is a perfect example. I'm glad you mentioned this, because in a year and a half ago, four angel mothers and one family, angel family, went to Paul Ryan's home. This is heat of the summer, very hot. The mothers and family members were wearing their memorial shirts of their children or their loved one, and with their individual Stolen Lives quilt banner of their loved one. And we wanted just a few minutes to talk with Speaker Paul Ryan. and to tell them their stories and just help him do a better job to represent Americans. And he absolutely refused. In fact, he jumped into his security detail Suburban and both vehicles just sped away. I mean, he didn't even come out to give his condolences or say, "I'm so sorry for the loss of your son or your daughter." You know, this is what we have in our leadership, Kyle. So if people don't understand that by, you know, now, you know, it's very obvious that every single politician knows what is taking place, but yet they sit on their hands and they're unwilling to protect you, the American. This is where we are today. That's very disturbing and actually very dangerous for our country.
Well said, Maria, and it reminds me of President Reagan saying that if you can't make your elected officials see the light, then make them feel the heat. So we appreciate all that you are doing to make them feel the heat on this very important issue. Maria, thank you very much. We will be right back with our next guest here on Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm Kyle Scheidler, filling in for Frank Gaffney, who is off today. Joining me now is Fred Flights. He's the Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs at the Center for Security Policy, a former CIA analyst, former Chief of Staff for Ambassador John Bolton at the U.S. State Department, and a former member of the Intelligence Committee as well, which is one of the reasons I wanted to have you on today, Fred, to talk about all of this crazy memo stuff that's really flying back and forth here in Washington. So, Fred Flights, thank you for joining me.
Hey, Kyle, good to be here.
So catch us up to speed a little bit on the most recent revelations. I know we've got some additional text messages between the FBI and DOJ lawyers that were involved in both the Clinton case and the Trump surveillance case, as well as some movement with the Intelligence Committee and the Democratic Minority Memo. So catch us up to speed on where the investigation stands right now.
Well, we know there's a second memo written by the House Intelligence Committee Democrats, which is a rebuttal to the memo written by the House Intelligence Committee Republicans. Adam Schiff is the author of it. Now, I understand from a source on the committee that this memo has a lot of classification problems. There is material put in there that would be difficult to declassify. And there's a number of commentators saying that these are traps that the Democrats laid. So when Trump does not declassify the information, they can accuse him of politicizing things, which I think is really an incredibly irresponsible way to handle national security. And I understand the Democratic memo is full of attacks on Congressman Schiff and Gowdy. It really represents, I think, a new low for intelligence oversight. The big development that I see for this week is that apparently the Steele dossier, that's this salacious, unverified dossier that was used as the main basis to get a warrant to spy on Carter Page, an aide in the Trump campaign from the FISA court. We found out this week, apparently, that Sidney Blumenthal, who's very close to Hillary Clinton, fed information to get it into the Steele dossier. This guy is one of the biggest political hacks in Washington. And, I mean, this case gets more and more bizarre, more and more instances of just gross efforts to manipulate and undermine our democratic system. The fact that this fake dossier was being pumped up with garbage being fed to it by one of Hillary Clinton's henchmen. I mean, Kyle, it just can't get any more bizarre.
Well, that's right, Fred. And, you know, it was certainly possible for the DOJ to represent to the FISA court that Christopher Steele had been a strong, reliable source in the past. But I don't think there's any way that they could reasonably represent Sidney Blumenthal as a reliable source here. So you almost have Christopher Steele acting as sort of a cutout for yet more Clintonistas.
It seems that way. And let's keep in mind, you know, the standard for U.S. intelligence agency to spy on an American is very high, and you have to get a warrant from a special secret court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court. But I think the standard to conduct surveillance against a member of a presidential campaign of another party must be exceedingly high. And that's why when a FISA warrant application was made in the fall of 2016 to spy on one of Trump's campaign aides, the court should have been told that the principal information was being paid for by the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee. Never mind what you just said, that some of the principal information was fed to the principal source by one of Clinton's lieutenants. And also, I think really one of the biggest scandals here is how the media just doesn't care. As serious as this is, because of their intense hatred of Donald Trump, they're just not going to report on this accurately. I mean, this isn't even a close call in terms of calling it a huge scandal and a risk to our democracy. But the mainstream media, they're just not going to tell the American people that.
You know, I think that's an excellent point, Fred Flights. Many reporters in Washington are always waiting for that Watergate moment, that real story of political wrongdoing and scandal. And here they have one open and available, and there's just simply no desire to cover it at all.
Yeah, we can fault President Trump for maybe making some indiscreet and undisciplined comments. That's fair. The media wants to go after him on that basis. That's fair. And we can say, you know, maybe the Russians were engaged in some type of activities that may have affected the U.S. election. My view is the Russians are always trying to mess with our democracy, and they didn't target either the Republican or the Democratic presidential campaigns. But this interference in the election by the Democratic Party and Hillary campaign and manipulation by the Obama administration, the evidence for this is overwhelming. And the media just isn't going to report it accurately. Every single day there's more revelations. The idea that Sidney Blumenthal could be involved, I was watching MSNBC this morning. They didn't mention this. And I mean, it's painful to watch MSNBC. I'm a Fox guy, as you know, Kyle. But I'm just thinking, like, what are these people thinking? What do they want to report? Well, what they do, it's 24/7, let's get Trump. And they don't realize the damage that's been done to our democracy by the Democrats, by the Democratic National Committee, and by the Obama administration.
I think that's very true, Fred. One of the positives, at least so far, is it looks like both the House and the Senate committees do not intend to let this go. We saw the Grassley memo come out regarding the referral of Christopher Steele for, you know, his role in all of this, the investigative referral. They don't seem to like they want to let this go. You know, it's obviously a tragedy what happened and the risk to our democracy. But is there an opportunity here to conduct some serious reforms to how we conduct intelligence in this country that are long overdue?
Well, first, let me say how proud I am of Congressman Nunez and other leading Republicans. They know the bias in the media. They know the bias among Democrats in Congress who are not going to call this straight. And they've just said, you know, we've had enough. We're going to release this information to the American people, even if we have to release memos only authored by Democratic staff and no Democratic input. And I was told by someone on the House Intelligence Committee, we can't share any classified with Democrats because they'll leak it if it will hurt Trump. So that's one thing. But I think the point you raise about intelligence reform is something we need to be thinking about. The process to get a warrant to spy on an American citizen obviously has serious flaws. If it's possible for this Carter Page warrant and the renewals to get through based on all this faulty information. Now, I've always been a defender of the FISA process. I don't agree that we should be shutting down these systems that allow the NSA to surveil American citizens who may have been in contact with terrorist suspects. But I got to tell you, I'm reconsidering my position on this. I think we have to look at this process because obviously there are serious flaws that were exploited by the Democrats.
I think that's a good point. Although, I mean, it's worth mentioning that it seems like Admiral Mike Rogers at the NSA was one of the heroes in all of this, ordering that audit of NSA's passing to FBI contractors, materials on Americans. So he seems to have done the right thing here. But it's without a doubt a number of checks and balances in this whole situation have failed.
And what happened to Rogers? after he did that, Obama officials tried to have him removed.
Oh, he was castigated.
Yeah.
And so that raises a question, too, which is, you know, if the people that we rely on to call foul when things go wrong are either, you know, in on the scheme, as a number of DOJ and FBI top leaders seem to have been, or alternatively are castigated if they do what they're constitutionally responsible for doing, which is, you know, calling things out when they're going wrong. I guess it goes back to who watches the watchman, Fred Flights.
Well, I think the top layers of every federal agency can have, you know, ambitious people or people who are too close to the institution and the establishment. And that's why you have to have strong leaders named by the president to make sure these organizations are governed, are managed honestly and non-politically. And I think that that's the check we have in our system. That's why presidents name heads of these agencies. That's why a careerist doesn't head them forever and ever. We know that's corrupting. That happened with J. Edgar Hoover. So I think that we have to have people at the top of these agencies, whether it's the State Department, the CIA, the Justice Department, to clean house and to insist that these people follow the law and perform their jobs ethically.
Well said, Fred Flights. We have to leave it there, but thank you so much. And thanks to all of you in the audience for joining us on one more Secure Freedom Radio. We will be back again tomorrow. Same time, same place, same channel. Thank you so much for joining us here on Secure Freedom Radio.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler, filling in for the great Frank Gaffney, who is off today. Joining me now is David Goldman. He's the author of How Civilizations Die. He's best known for a series of essays at the Asia Times under the pseudonym Spangler, and really a man whose work I turn to whenever I'm trying to figure out all that's going on at the intersection of strategy and economy. David, thank you for joining us on Secure Freedom Radio.
Always my pleasure. Thanks.
So I wanted to talk to you about the recent situation in the stock market. You know, President Trump tweeted out something about how the failure to report all the good news about the economy had an impact on the stock market's downturn. Is that really true? I mean, is the stock market's downturn happening despite all the good going on in the U.S. economy, or was there something else at work?
The stock market has a problem, which is that valuations are extremely high. When you're paying 18 times forward earnings, expected earnings for a stock, which is what the S&P is trading at, you really want to be pretty sure you're going to get the earnings you're paying for. Over the past couple of weeks, we've had a lot of important earnings disappointments from market leaders. Started really with Daimler-Benz a week ago in Germany. Then it went through to UPS, Google, and so forth. A lot of the problem is U.S. companies and some global companies simply did not invest during the Obama recovery. They've got a huge amount of catch-up to do in terms of investing. That will eat into future profits in some cases. So uncertainty about future profits is going to take prices down a bit.
Is this a market correction that, in your view, is overdue?
Well, it's not so much overdue. We're in a late cycle. We've got growth booming all over the world. Production inputs, some of them are going to get a bit more costly. There's no way around that. So in some cases, for example, UPS helped take the market down. It was one of the worst performers in the past week. Said, you know, we're going to have to spend a lot of money on planes, a lot of money computerizing warehouses that you didn't anticipate, and that's going to eat into our profits. Bang, I got crushed. Google underperformed. That's a giant monopoly, and everyone's worried, both on buying Google at a very rich price, what happens if the monopoly pricing erodes? Google's been a market leader downwards. ExxonMobil and Chevron did very poorly. These are companies which did not meet investors' expectations about oil production. And it's simply the case that they haven't been buying equipment. They haven't been paying for capital investment at the level they did back in 2013, 2014, the last time production boomed. So they're going to run into some accidents. They'll undershoot performance. So selectively, you have market leaders lagging, and that casts doubt upon the stability of earnings in the market. But it's not a crash. It's simply maybe the market was a bit expensive.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the situation going on in China. The reaction we saw from the Shanghai Composite Index was not the same as what we saw from some of the other markets. And people have been talking for some time that there's a risk to what's going on in China economically, but we haven't really seen the effects from that. What we've seen is, in fact, a great deal of stability. Why is that? And is it something that will continue to go on moving forward?
You know, it's interesting. If you look at the performance of H shares, which were traded internationally, not the A shares in Shanghai, the Chinese financials are still up about 10% from the beginning of the year, the big banks and insurance companies, even though they gave back a good deal of their gains. The fact that the financials are outperformers does not indicate that we're dealing with a problem of systemic risk, because if the system were at risk, you'd see the financials taking the biggest hit. I think the problem with Shanghai is you just had a world stock market pullback. I don't know if correction is the right word. The Chinese are going into their Lunar New Year. Everyone's going to be off for 2 weeks. So you've got a lot of profit taking and clearing out of positions ahead of the home. In response to an unknown risk overseas. Chinese economy is doing fine. There's no indication that they have any particular problems. All of the surveys based on satellite imagery and other hard data give pretty much the same picture that the government data do, that it's, you know, a solid 6% plus expansion.
Why do you think we see a difference between what you've described there, which makes sense to me, and what we've seen from some other China watchers, you know, who raise questions about state and local government debt for the Chinese, you know, over construction, some of these other issues? Why does it get reported that way?
China is a huge place. There are thousands of people who make a living reporting on China, and you get a huge spread of opinions. A couple of years ago, China risk was the mantra of every hedge fund manager. The thing that could bring the world economy down was China risk, China debt. It now appears that with profits rising at a very good clip, double digits, Chinese companies are able to build down leverage. The deleveraging campaign of the Chinese government appears to be working gradually. So I think the risks have considerably diminished. As I said, if debt were the problem, if it were a debt bubble, you should see the Chinese banks performing the worst, and that hasn't been the case at all.
You know, one of the things that strikes me is I've seen a number of high-level defense officials here in the United States who have said, you know, tell me who the global economic leader is in the next 10 years, and I'll tell you who the superpower will be. And obviously, they're sort of hinting backhandedly about China. Where do we stand in terms of U.S. competition with China in the economic space? Are we ahead? Are we behind? What do we need to do?
The United States has lost an enormous amount of high-tech manufacturing capacity. American companies have followed what they like to call a capital-light approach, which is we let other people build the hardware, we build the apps. So the erosion of the American industrial base in high-tech is a long-term alarming trend. For example, Cisco used to be the world leader in telecommunications equipment. They're practically out of that business. China's Huawei now has 70% of the market in telecommunications. Now, I think that's both a threat to national security, because if we can't deal with our own high-tech systems, they'll be hackable and fragile. And it's also a danger to our long-term economic health.
I want to pivot a little bit, still talking about strategy in the economy. You recently wrote a piece about the situation in Turkey. Turkey's economy, it seems to me, pretty dire straits. And the behavior we're seeing from the Turkish government and Erdogan in terms of expansionism and sort of adventurism in Syria, is it an attempt to offset that? Is that something that's sustainable? And ultimately, if it continues this way, does Turkey implode or do they explode?
Turkey is run by a typical third world dictator who prints money and makes a lot of loans and allows people to buy a lot of houses and cars and refrigerators to keep them happy. Now, Turkey has had some economic growth, but at the expense of a huge surge in imports and a very sharp widening of its trade deficit and a very fast rate of credit growth. That's not sustainable. You can't run a trade deficit of 7, 8, 9% of GDP, which is what they're doing now, forever. You know, you'd have to borrow the equivalent of your GDP every 10 years or so. So the question is, who is giving Turkey the money and how long could that go on? I think the probable answer is Turkey is getting a lot of financing from China and from Qatar, who mean us no good and would very much like to separate the Turks from NATO and encourage them to pursue a policy which is unfriendly to us. And I think to some extent they're succeeding. The only good news you could say about Turkey is that Erdogan sometimes trips over his own shoelaces, so he gets himself into hot water, both with us, the Russians, and others. He's not a strategic genius, and he may end up solving his own problem by doing something really stupid.
Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. David Goldman, it's always a great pleasure to hear you lay things out for us so clearly. We appreciate it. We hope to have you back again soon. All right, coming up next, we'll be joined by Fred Flights of the Center for Security Policy here on Secure Freedom Radio.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.